I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Day one of the impeachment trial of President Trump set out to determine whether a former president could be sanctioned and prevented from holding office ever again. It was billed as a procedural debate and began with a graphic and horrifying 13-minute video of the January 6th assault on the Capitol. Later, impeachment manager Jamie Raskin pleaded tearfully, "This cannot be our future." Bruce Castor's presentation was a confusing, rambling, and muddled defense of the president. David Schoen, Trump's other attorney, called the proceeding a snap impeachment. Joining us is Jacqueline Thompson of the National Law Journal. She was watching as well. She's here to break down some of the arguments. And Jacqueline Thompson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with that video. And I think, like most of our listeners, probably like you, Jacqueline, I've seen lots of videos over the last month of what happened that day on January 6th. But there was something about the way this was pulled together, edited, interspersed with Trump's comments that really made it difficult to watch, but also very powerful. What was your takeaway?
I agree. It was incredibly powerful. It was very striking, the fact that they were able to pull together all of this evidence and really create a timeline of the series of events that happened on January 6th. They showed step by step how the president's supporters moved from his speech at the Ellipse down toward the Capitol at the president's urging and then forced their way into the building. They showed how close they were to getting into the House, the way they rifled through desks in the Senate. And, you know, we all saw this footage in different ways. We've all seen different clips of it, but we haven't seen it all put together in the way that we saw it yesterday. And I think that's what really made the difference there.
I mean, this is a trial, essentially, about impeachment. But this was an appeal, a personal, even emotional appeal to the members of the U.S. Senate. Do you think it was effective? Is there maybe it's too soon to ask that question.
You know, I think it definitely had to resonate with them. You know, you go to the lead impeachment manager, Jamie Raskin, and you talk about the way he emotionally described having to go to the Capitol one day after burying his son, the way his daughter was there, his son-in-law were there, and how everyone in the building was, you know, making calls, making texts to say what they thought could be their goodbyes. That was also happening to the senators. They are not just the jury in this trial, but they are also the witnesses and the victims of it. So I think all of that combined together, it really did have to resonate with the senators. Whether it will be enough to change their votes, that's left to be seen.
Let me play a clip from Jamie Raskin. He is the impeachment manager from the House of Representatives. And this is one of his closing arguments from yesterday. Let's give it a listen. It's about 50 seconds. And then Jacqueline will talk about it.
Senators, this cannot be our future. This cannot be the future of America. We cannot have presidents inciting and mobilizing mob violence against our government and our institutions because they refuse to accept the will of the people under the Constitution of the United States. Much less can we create a new January exception in our precious, beloved Constitution that prior generations have died for and fought for, so the corrupt presidents have several weeks to get away with whatever it is they want to do. History does not support a January exception in any way, so why would we invent one for the future?
Jacqueline, what is he referring to when he talks about the January exception?
What they're describing there is this concept that a president can do anything he wants in the final days of his term, but because he would no longer be in office at the time of his Senate trial, he therefore could not be convicted, which is effectively, you know, the argument that the president's attorneys have been putting forward. They're saying because he is no longer president, there cannot be a trial. And that was really the core of yesterday's argument, you know, whether or not they could actually hold this trial, whether or not it was constitutional. The House Democrats, the House managers, they're arguing that this would create a January exception, that any president who did any sort of wrongdoing in the final days of office, therefore, would be completely exempt from any sort of accountability, especially considering the protections that a sitting president has. You know, he can't be indicted, he can't be prosecuted while he's in office. Impeachment is really the only tool that they have in that arsenal in order to hold him accountable. So what the House managers are saying here, and what Jamie Raskin was referring to there, is this idea that they still have to continue to hold a former president accountable, even if he's only days out of office.
Let me just ask you about Bruce Castor's performance, and I should say to our listeners, he's from the Philadelphia area, so he is well known in this neck of the woods. But I would say by almost any perspective or calculation, he did the president no favors.
He really didn't. It was not, I spent a lot of time in court. I listened to a lot of legal arguments. That was not something that I have ever seen in a court of law or saw in a court of impeachment the last time around. I cannot imagine that the president was happy with that performance. Even Senate Republicans came out and said, I don't know what happened there. Lindsey Graham, one of the president's most staunch allies, said, I don't know what he was getting after. And Bill Cassidy, who was one of the few Republicans to vote in favor of the constitutionality of the trial, he said, it really did come down to the arguments. The House managers had a good presentation. The president's legal team did everything they could to avoid talking about the question. It was several minutes into Castor's presentation, and we were speaking with each other going, okay, when exactly is he going to get to this, and where is this going? And, I'm not really sure where it went.
Well, and even to quote Alan Dershowitz, who said, I have no idea what he is doing. Let me play another clip, and this is former President Trump's impeachment lawyer, David Schoen. He also spoke yesterday, and this is one of the arguments that he was making for the senators. Let's give it a listen. It's 49 seconds.
They say you need this trial before the nation can heal, that the nation cannot heal without it. I say our nation cannot possibly heal with it. With this trial, you will open up new and bigger wounds across the nation, for a great many Americans see this process for exactly what it is, a chance by a group of partisan politicians seeking to eliminate Donald Trump from the American political scene and seeking to disenfranchise 74 million plus American voters and those who dare to share their political beliefs and vision of America. They hated the results of the 2016 election and want to use this impeachment process to further their political agenda.
So what is he saying there, Jacqueline?
Well, what he's referring to there is the disqualification penalty for a conviction of anyone in a Senate trial. The argument here that House managers are making is that the president is so dangerous that he can never be allowed to run for federal office ever again. And when I say president, I mean former President Donald Trump. What they're saying there is, David Schoen's argument is that this is not something that's actually a constitutional error. This is just an attempt to prevent Donald Trump from being on future ballots because they're so afraid of his political power, because they're so afraid that he could defeat Democrats again. That's really running up against the House manager's argument, which is about the danger that he poses, the fact that he's undermined the election results time and time again, that he's taken action to try and, undo the will of the people in the November election. So David Schoen's argument, that really is more of a political argument and less of the constitutional arguments that yesterday's hearing was really supposed to center around.
But is he saying that Donald Trump won the election? Is that part of the argument coming from the defense team?
So it's interesting because Bruce Castor earlier on in the argument said, Joe Biden won the election.
Right.
That cannot have gone well with Donald Trump. And there's been reporting that he was upset over that as well. So, I don't think that's something they're necessarily trying to center their arguments around because they do recognize how divisive this is. Instead, they're trying to be more forward looking and they're trying to say, these House Democrats are trying to subvert the will of the American people in future elections, not so much in this past election.
a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. So the vote was 56-44. So six Republicans voted with all the Democrats. So what happens today, Jacqueline?
Today we'll see opening arguments from the House managers. We can expect to see more video like we saw yesterday. The House managers, they'll get 16 hours to present their arguments over 2 days. I'm not entirely sure if they'll actually use all of their time. They didn't use all of their time yesterday. They left off an extra 30 minutes or so because they felt that their arguments were solid enough that they didn't have to do anything more. And as Jamie Raskin joked, the Senate is the most bipartisan when it comes to ending proceedings early. I think that, you know, we'll see a lot of video. We'll hear a lot of emotion. We'll hear a lot of firsthand accounts of what exactly happened in the Capitol that day. Because remember, these managers, they aren't just the prosecutors in the case, but like the senators who are serving as the jury, they are also the witnesses and they are also the victims. They'll be able to provide this firsthand account of what exactly happened, of what they saw, of what they witnessed. They'll be able to dive into media accounts the way they've done in their briefs. And again, they'll definitely be returning to that video that we saw yesterday. I can imagine we will see more and more footage of what exactly happened in the Capitol and what happened in the chamber where the trial itself is being held.
Is the result, though, a foregone conclusion in order to actually find the president guilty? They need to convince 11 more Republicans, they meaning the Democrats, over to their side. Do you think that's mathematically possible, Jacqueline?
I think it will be difficult. I don't want to rule anything out at this point, but I think for a lot of people, it does appear to be a foregone conclusion, just because even on these constitutionality questions, really threshold questions for holding the trial, we have seen the vast majority of Republicans shift over to one side over the other. You know, we do have Bill Cassidy. That was an interesting flip yesterday where he said we were on the initial vote last month. He didn't vote in favor of the constitutionality of the trial, but yesterday he did. And he did so because he said the House manager's arguments were more persuasive, that he is supposed to be an impartial juror, and that's the way he was approaching it. At the same time, he almost immediately got political backlash from the Republican Party in Louisiana, which I can imagine will be used in future political ads. You know, there's a lot of different pressures coming around here for these Republican senators, whether or not they're going to go along with what they actually see during the trial. You know, I don't think that's necessarily what we can expect, but I wouldn't entirely rule it out either.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times to give us a bit of a breakdown about some of the arguments yesterday in the U.S. Senate. Jacqueline Thompson of the National Law Journal, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Coming up, remembering the life and legacy of Philadelphia-born contralto Marian Anderson and her historic performance in 1939 in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. On April 9th, 1939, world-famous singer Marian Anderson gave one of the most important performances of the 20th century in front of the Lincoln Memorial. She had been prevented from performing at Constitution Hall by the DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution, because she was black. The crowd on the National Mall was huge, some 75,000 people, and she reportedly was terrified. Marian Anderson later wrote, "I could not run away from this situation. If I had anything to offer, I would have to do so now." And she did. A new PBS American Experience documentary about Marian Anderson, Voice of Freedom, premieres Monday night at 9 on TV 12. Our guests are featured in the film, and they join us to tell us about Marian Anderson, her extraordinary contralto voice, and the times in which she lived. And let me introduce them to you. Angela Brown is a dramatic soprano who has performed on the leading opera and symphonic stages across six continents. She made her acclaimed Metropolitan Opera debut in the title role of Aida. This was during the 2004-2005 season. And she's got a podcast called Melanated Moments in Classical Music. Angela Brown, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty. I'm excited.
We are as well. And joining us by Skype is Adrienne Lentz Smith. She is Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Duke University. She teaches courses on Black lives, Black freedom struggle, and history in fact and fiction. Adrienne Lentz Smith, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation, and you can do it several different ways. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Adrienne, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you and just talk about the importance, the historical importance of what Marian Anderson did on that day in 1939. How do you see it?
Well, I see it, well, one, it's amazing, right? As you mentioned, 75,000 people gathered at the Lincoln Memorial, a site that had been dedicated only 17 years earlier in a segregated ceremony in which African Americans weren't included, essentially, except for one censored speaker. So there's the sort of reclaiming of the Lincoln Memorial. But you also have to remember, this is 1939. Yeah. It's the cusp of World War II. It's in the midst of Americans learning the language of anti-fascism and learning to oppose as opposed to embrace white supremacy. And the NAACP uses Anderson and her concert to remind not just the nation, but the world of the kind of ideals the nation should embrace, but wasn't currently embracing.
Angela Brown, I'd like, and I do want to play just a section of Marian Anderson singing My Country 'Tis of Thee, but as a singer, as an opera singer yourself, what do you make of this performance?
Well, this had to be a very heady time for her. She was, of course, had performer nerves, but can you imagine, on top of the performer nerves, she had the nerves of being an African American and being put really on the spot to be the end all and be all for all things Black at that time. And I'm sure she was crazy inside. I could just imagine.
Well, I've seen shots of the 75,000 people who were there. Interestingly, mm-hmm. a very mixed audience, lots of Black people, lots of white people, and mm-hmm. the kind of enthusiasm and expectations on their faces is really quite extraordinary. Let me just play, it's a small portion of Marian Anderson, and she is singing My Country 'Tis of Thee. She makes a very subtle but very important change in the words, and I do want to talk about that after this, after we give it a listen again in front of the Lincoln Memorial, 1939. just beautiful. Adrienne mm-hmm. Lentz-Smith, she changes the words of the "we sing" instead of the "I sing." How significant? What do you see as the significance of that?
It's a claim, right? The "we" is a reminder of national community on the one hand, right? So some audience members might hear that as we're all part of this American nation. But on this, at the same time, it's speaking to the Black folks listening, right? I am part of you. We are here together. And we are sharing this moment because it is about our presence and our fate.
And what do you hear, Angela Brown, in her voice? And we're going to play some more music during the interview, but just help us understand a contralto voice.
Well, actually, when she was singing at this time, the voice was more mezzo-like. Contralto is a very low, almost tenor sound that we heard her sing in later years. But she had this lilt, this smooth, velvety quality to her voice that also had a cut and a shimmer to it. So it was very mezzo-like, and she was very, I could hear her confidence along, her confidence in what she was saying, but along with probably a little nerves in there, you know, because she had all those people she was singing in front of.
Something so. You can relate to, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, she was born and raised in Philadelphia, so that's one of the reasons we wanted to do this show. And if I can go back to you, Angela Brown, and this is from the documentary, it was really Black churches in Philadelphia where she got her start. She was known as the baby contralto, singing hymns, singing spirituals. Help us understand, I guess, the role of the church in helping maybe any Black singer, but certainly Marian Anderson in sort of shaping her as a performer.
Well, I too had the opportunity to grow up in Black church, and my grandfather was a Baptist minister, so I was always singing in church. And the church is very, I can imagine back then that was the place, the go-to place for any black musician at the time, because you had your audience. It was built in, and all of the cream of the crop of musicians were part of Black churches at that time. So you were able to get your studying done and your practice done on the pianos in the church. And you had the church edifice to rehearse in, and you had the congregation that was there to support you, to push you on, and that could also raise monies for you in order to go out and then perfect your craft even further. So Black church and with Black musicians has always been very important.
Interestingly, her father died when she was young. He was hurt in an accident. Her mother was apparently an extraordinary influence on her. And I know from Angela Brown, from talking to you before we going on the air, your mother, who was a singer, was compared at times to Marian Anderson. Help us understand that.
Yes, my mother, when she was in high school, she graduated in 1960. She was able to get a scholarship to the Jordan School of Music here at Butler University in Indianapolis, Indiana. And she went to a few lessons, and she decided at that time that that wasn't going to be for her. But they always compared my mother, who was a soprano, but they compared her to Marian Anderson because that was all we had to compare, you know, as far as someone of note. But my mother had that kind of voice that could have been a great classical singer, but she decided to get married and have us. So
she did that instead, which was an interesting choice that Marian Anderson had as well. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Angela Brown. She's a soprano, an acclaimed opera and symphonic performer. And she, as I mentioned earlier, made her acclaimed Metropolitan Opera debut in the title role of Aida. This was a number of years ago. Also with us, Adrian Lentz-Smith, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Duke University. And both of them are featured in this new documentary about Marian Anderson. And it is called Voice of Freedom. And again, it premieres TV 12 Monday night at 9 o'clock. We're talking about Marian Anderson, who we all know was born and raised here in Philadelphia. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Adrian Lentz-Smith, in the documentary, she is refused to be refused her entrance into the Philadelphia Musical Academy because she is black. Also, later we learn about the summer of 1999, which was filled with race riots. Take us back to that time. What was happening in America when it came to racial issues?
The Red Summer of 1919, or even the World War I era, was a really grim period in American history and in the history of Jim Crow and white supremacy. Lynchings were going up during the war, and particularly after. Segregation was as embedded and sort of entrenched as it would ever be. The President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, had brought Southern Democrats into his administration, the architects of white supremacy in their home states. So, you know, it was a dark, dark period in a lot of ways. At the same time, there was this war for democracy, ostensibly, that African Americans tried to use as an opening to challenge Jim Crow. And what we see in 1919 in places like Chicago, where Marian Anderson went for a concert and walked into the middle of the Chicago race riot, yeah, was vicious white mobs rampaging through the streets as African Americans trained in the war and empowered by the moment tried to fend them off.
I think by now, hopefully, we have all seen, I'm going to go back to you, Adrian Lentz-Smith, photographs, and this is Washington, D.C. This is in the 1920s, and we see this giant rally of members of the KKK in full KKK regalia walking through the nation's capital. Help us understand that, what that moment was about.
Right, and that's just 3 years after, like, the Red Summer. Washington had its own riot, which involved a lot of white.
Oh, dear. I think we lost Adrian Lentz-Smith. We will try to get her back. Angela Brown, I'm going to segue only because we got an email from David, and this goes back to Marian Anderson singing My Country, Tis of Thee. And David says, you just spoke of Marian Anderson changing the word from I to we, but it's not often noticed that she also changed the word of to the word to. Thus she sang, my country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, to thee we sing. This is tremendously powerful. I hadn't, frankly, mm-hmm, noticed that. Angela, anything you want to add to that?
Well, actually, I did, and it was funny that Adrian didn't mention that, but yes, to thee we sing. She is making she's pointing the finger to America. To thee we sing. We are here and we are not going anywhere. And we want to take our rightful place to be able to sing. To thee we sing. Because we are going to have, I mean, we're land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring.
Right.
You know, and we want to be counted as part of the fabric of America. We're here and we stay.
Yes, indeed you do. And we're trying to get Adrian hooked up again, but let me go back to you, Angela Brown. There's a part of the documentary where she learns the German leader and the feeling that the leader fit her voice, it fit her personality. Can you expand on that? Help us understand how you think that worked for her.
Well, you know, from what I have read and researched about Marian Anderson, she was a very quiet woman, a very demure woman. She had control of herself and her body and her person. And when you are singing German Lieder, you are not an outspoken, flamboyant opera singer, you know. And so the concert repertoire fit her personality more. Yes, she was able to give inflections and interpretation through her voice, but it suited her the way concert music was performed at the time. And so it spoke very well for what she liked to do and what she could bring to the operatic or to the concert stage.
There's scenes in the documentary, again, where she's touring the South. This, of course, was at the heart of Jim Crow, performing in Black colleges and theaters and churches. This was a, you know, rich time of Black arts and culture. But at the same time, there were trains where Black passengers weren't allowed. And as someone who has traveled the world, I'd just be curious about your thoughts about that.
Well, at that time, there was a lot of train travel, of course, to get where you had to go. And where now we're very comfortable on trains, you know, large seats, and you have your little tray table, and you can go to the restroom, and you can eat. Imagine not being able really to do any of that. And then the facilities that you did have were not clean, that you were packed in there like cattle. You know, everyone shoulder to shoulder. I'm sure that the it wasn't very comfortable, is what I'm saying. And she couldn't have a sleeper car to where she could recline during the evening part of the train ride and refresh herself for the next day. She had to bring her food because there was no food that was available for her to buy on the train. And I know how it feels as far as a touring situation is, where you have to sit on a bus all night and then get off the bus and go straight on the stage. Throw some water on your face, honey, shake that gown out as best you can and get up on the stage. I imagine it was 10 times harder for Marian Anderson, but she persevered because
she
wanted it.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, and we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. I'm happy to say that Adrienne Lentz-Smith is back with us, also with us, Angela Brown. We're talking about the life, the music, the voice, the legacy of Marian Anderson. And again, it's part of a new documentary, Voice of Freedom. It premieres on TV12 Monday night at 9 o'clock. And we are talking with them about this time and, of course, about this extraordinary person. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with our guests about Marian Anderson, her life, her legacy. Adrienne Lentz-Smith is Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Duke University, back with us. Thank you for coming back on the show. We lost you there for a second. Good old phones have you hooked up with us again. And again, Angela Brown with us. She's a soprano. She has a podcast called Melanated Moments in Classical Music. And we are talking about the life, the music, the voice of Marian Anderson. In fact, let me play, and this is something, Angela Brown, that you picked for us. This is Marian Anderson singing Florence Price's My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord. Let's just give it a quick listen.
Before I'd stay in hell one day,
beautiful. Marian Anderson singing My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord, written by Florence Price. And thank you, Angela Brown, for suggesting that piece of music. If you don't mind, I do want to go back to you, Adrian Lentz, and you were talking right before we lost you off of Skype about what was happening in the 20s in America, in Washington, D.C., with the KKK walking openly through the streets of Washington, D.C. While we lost you, Angela Brown was talking about what it must have been like for Marian Anderson to tour the South and be, you know, forced to sit in black-only sections of trains. And I wonder if you could just add some of your perspective to that part of our history.
Sure. So Angela mentioned the physical discomfort, which would potentially affect her performance, but think also about the mental work involved in feeling unsafe, in trying to determine where it was safe to go, in trying to anticipate whether or not your trip or your performance would be met with hostility. All of that stuff takes its toll as well. And we have to keep in mind that in the 1920s, the Klan was ascendant and it was powerful. It was a political force. It nearly bought Valparaiso University. You know, we wouldn't be surprised to think of the Klan marching openly if we would recall how powerful it was. Hugo Black, in fact, who would go on to become a Supreme Court justice and one of the sponsors of Marian Anderson's 1939 concert at the Lincoln Memorial, was himself a Klan member before he ran for Senate in Alabama in the 1920s.
So important to remember this history. Let me segue back to you, Angela Brown. And I guess I'm truncating some of Marian Anderson's career here, but she does go to Europe. She has a performance at Town Hall in New York. It does not go well. She has bad reviews. She secludes herself for some time, and then she goes to Europe. And she comes back, and it sounds like she's a different person with a different kind of voice. And I'm curious about what you think that meant for her.
Well, you know, as a performer, when you have moments in your life where things just don't go well, especially when you've built yourself up for this big time to have yourself premiered in New York and it bombs. I mean, it hurts. And her having that time away to think, to rehone her skills and then go to Europe to be out of the prying eyes of those in America, because in America, it is her home and she has to deal with all the racism and her family and friends that are looking at her and the whole race of black people. Okay. Looking at her and expecting right. wonderful things. And if it doesn't go well, then yeah, you retreat for a while. And so then she went to Europe and she came back with more confidence in herself and more grounded. And the voice did change because she was having, you know, in the course of a woman's life as a singer, the voice will change. And so then she came back with this more mellow, creamy, syrupy voice that's more contralto sounding. And she persevered.
Yeah. Let me go back to you, Adrian Lentz-Smith, and she does continue to perform. She continues to perform to segregated audiences. Now, sometimes, you know, they were black people on one side, white people on another, or black people in the balcony, white people down in the orchestra. And there's a performance that's included in this documentary where she gives a kind of a, after she's done, she gives a sort of a quick nod to the white members of the audience and a deep bow to the black members of the audience. And what was she saying? What was she doing there?
I think it's a little bit like the we that you mentioned in My Country, 'Tis of Thee, right? It's a way of speaking to that part of the audience that is subtle, that's not confrontational, but is still incredibly meaningful, and that acknowledges, creates, and sustains the sense of community of fellow black folks who are just trying to get through this world with some beauty and some joy. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that the NAACP, they did not want her to perform for segregated audiences, and they had a bit of a tussle for a while. Adrian, can you speak to that?
Sure. I mean, as with anything, the Black freedom struggle changes over time, and that pushback would especially come in the late 1940s, early 1950s, when the movement itself had changed, when the expectations were different, and in which the challenges to segregation were increasingly more overt. Whereas Anderson had spent a career making the best of the circumstances available to her. She'd never chosen to be an activist. The moment chose her and kind of pulled her into it. And so by her understanding, people were asking her to do something that she'd never quite promised to do. And to her credit, eventually, when the question was called over and over again by the early 1950s, she came around.
Let me get Janet to join our conversation. Janet calling into Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air, Janet.
Hi, Maury. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm just wondering when this rift will change in the United States. You know, Black people are wonderful people, and we're still getting the short end of the stick. It's like built into the fabric of this country that they will never take their foot off our necks. Marian Anderson was fabulous. You know, and we have to do these special shows to let people know that she was fabulous. When are we just going to be accepted and this madness of racism go away? I'll take my answer off the air.
Jen, it's such a profound question. I'm going to put that first to you, Angela Brown. Your thoughts?
You know, Miss Janet, I don't know. All I know is that I have to keep being excellent. And when we have examples like Marian Anderson, I mean, you can't poo-poo the fact that she was fabulous. And I'm going to continue my march to be shiny. And I would suggest that we all do that. Because what can we do? You said something so profound. It's knit into the fabric of America. So it is what it is, but I don't have to be what they say I am. I'm going to be what God says I am and who I say I'm going to be. So I'm just going to continue to be excellent and keep moving, keep it pushing.
Adrian Lynn Smith, the same to you. And just as Jenna was asking that, I was thinking about, I mean, Marian Anderson was excellent. And for so much of her life, she had to face just profound discrimination, including what happened at the Constitution Hall in April 1939.
And, I mean, I love Angela's phrasing, I'm going to continue my march to be shiny. But there's a way that, you know, the question of when this will be over is not a question to put to the people who are suffering and struggling to change it, but to those folks who are architects and sustainers of an inequitable power structure who are defending it, right? I suspect that we will be struggling for a long time. I am also confident that we are going to continue to create beautiful things in the midst of that struggle. I think education helps. I wouldn't be a professor if I didn't think that. And we can look at the other artists, you know, the way in which Black women feel empowered to intervene in the political space has changed over time. So we can look at someone like Beyonce, you know, who, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that she and Marian Anderson are the same kind of performer, but I would say that Beyonce has been remarkable for taking her public platform and embedding a new understanding of Black feminism, like depictions of Black history, and celebration of Black art in her public work. And I think that that does something. And it's been fascinating for me as a professor to see what my students pick up on and where they like are inspired by those kind of performers to go educate themselves.
I'm going to segue Angela Brown back to Marian Anderson. She made her Met debut. This was 1955. I think mm-hmm. she broke the color barrier. Yes. You made your Met debut. This was what, back in 2004. But
yes.
I guess speak to the, you know, talk about excellence, right? Speak to that, what that means to have been part of the Metropolitan Opera.
Oh, well, Marian Anderson never saw herself as an opera singer. That's one reason why it took so long for her to do opera. But of course, the Metropolitan Opera wasn't ready for her until it was ready for her. And having her do Ulrika in Umbalo and Máscara in 1955, I mean, I'm sure that she was excited beyond excitement, because I know how I felt when I made my debut at the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, it's the pinnacle sure. of being an opera singer. Everyone in the world wants to make it to the Met. And it was just a wonderful time in operatic history, not only for Marian Anderson, but for Black people that are striving to do anything in the arts and anything that they pick up to do in any profession. So,
Adrienne Lynn Smith, John has a question. He says, I recall seeing a portrait of Marian Anderson with Paul Robeson in the National Portrait Gallery. What was their affiliation? Do you know what their affiliation was?
They knew each other, right? If Paul Robeson was really active in left political circles and Anderson was more reticent, so they knew each other as professionals. I'm not sure how much time they spent together as friends, but I know that she did not sort of throw herself into the fray of radical politics as fully as Robeson did. But Robeson is an interesting person to think about alongside Anderson, because he too moved between spirituals, mastered theater, had the responsibility to represent the race, broadly speaking, even as he was a person trying to, like, make space for himself in the world.
I'm going to put this to you, Angela Brown. We found a performance of you and a group of other Black opera singers. This was in honor of last year's Juneteenth, and you're performing Lift Every Voice and Sing, often called the Black National Anthem. But just yes. Before we hear this, just what that particular piece of music means to you.
Well, first of all, I was honored to be a part of the Purple Robe series that Nicole Heaston started and brought together all those beautiful voices to sing the Black National Anthem during a time that was so raw for Americans with the social unrest of last year. And to sing Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, it is a song that makes you proud of what's to be, but brings you back, lets you know what we have gone through as a people, and that we have to continue marching on so that we can become excellent and have our day to hopefully have our day to become part of this American quilt. As I said before, we're here and we're here to stay.
I'm glad you are. Angela Brown, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And you can check out her podcast, Melanated Moments in Classical Music. Adrienne Lynn Smith, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Duke University. And again, you can check out this documentary about Marian Anderson, Voice of Freedom, premieres Monday night at 9 o'clock on TV 12. And we do want to close things out with Lift Every Voice and Sing. Let's give it a listen.